Well, we've all probably had times in our lives when we reflect on the existence that we all share, how small we can sometimes feel in the universe. Why does the universe exist, and what is the nature of time and space? These are no small questions, my friends. Maybe you're a stargazer, or maybe you like to teach your children or grandchildren about space and the planets and other phenomena like supernovas or black holes, or perhaps you go a bit deeper and want to understand the science of quantum theory, planetary science, astronomy, or cosmology. Well, our next guest is a rock star of science. I'm sure he's getting tired of being introduced as a rock star. You'll know him as the presenter of several highly acclaimed science programs for the BBC, and he joins me ahead of his Australian tour. Professor Brian Cox, welcome to you, sir.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
You'll be in Australia next week, travelling around the country. Not your first time. This is with your new live on stage show called Horizons. It sounds quite spectacular. What kind of journey will you be taking people on?
Well, it's you've asked many of the questions that I don't try to answer. I say at the start, actually, if I knew the answers to those questions that you posed, I'd charge more for tickets.
Well, it'd be a short show as well. Yeah.
The meaning of life. And then, but it begins with, we use huge screens. So the first thing is a quick tour of the universe using the new James Webb images, actually, from the Webb Space Telescope, which are an astonishing gift, which are just coming in all the time. But pretty quickly, I start talking about, as you said, the nature of space and time. It's a remarkable thing that in studying black holes, which are things that we can see, so we have photographs of black holes now, remarkably, one in the center of a galaxy, 55 million light years away, this thing is 6 billion times the mass of the sun. It's just 6 billion times the mass of our star. And those things are beginning to force us to think about these deep questions, in particular, what space is and what time is. And I find that remarkable. I mean, even as I say the words, you know, this is one of the things that I think about all the time. But it's still astonishing, isn't it, that you can look at something that sits there in the sky, that you can point a telescope at, that forces you to ask the question, what is time?
What is Which time? Is one of the things that I'm going to have to put that to you, because I'm sure that my 5-year-old daughter is going to ask me one day, and I can basically just steal your answer and say that I came up with it to her.
Well, the answer is that we're just beginning to get an insight. And so put it this way, we think that it emerges from something deeper. So what does that mean? Well, if you think about consciousness, for example, think about us now having this conversation. What is that? What is that thing? This thing that allows us to write music and experience the world and see its beauty and all those things. It's something that comes from a load of atoms that are stuck together in some pattern, which is you and me and your daughter, right? Is it what she is? She's a pattern of atoms, some of them as old as time, some of them cooked in the furnaces of long dead stars. It's an amazing thing. But out of that comes something much more complicated. And we're beginning to think that time is like that. So it comes from something deeper. What is the deeper thing? Well, it's quantum theory, which you referred to. But we don't really know what the building blocks of that are. But we get in a sense that there are building blocks. And I repeat that, you know, building blocks of time. It's an astonishing idea.
In your adventures around the world, you must get into some fascinating conversation with people from various religions. When we talk about this idea of the, you know, the eternal nature of the atoms that make up you and me, and whether or not that one day they will, you know, be forming new stars, do they sort of latch onto that idea as perhaps that is an eternal life or a form of it at least?
Well, I mean, one of the other central planks of this study of black holes, and indeed all of physics, is that information is not destroyed. So that really does mean, and in the context of black holes, and Stephen Hawking thought about this back in the 1970s, means that if you throw a book into a black hole, what happens to it? In Einstein's description, it goes to the end of time, the end of time sitting inside. It just disappears from the universe forever. But if you burn a book, if you set fire to a book, then in principle, not in practice because it's too hard, but in principle, if you gather everything that comes off the book, then and you measure it all, capture it all, you could reconstruct every page. You could reconstruct the story in the book. And so that is the same in principle with us, right? It's actually one of the foundations of physics. It's called determinism, right? The fact that if you know everything about something at some point, then you can predict what it's going to do in the future and what it was doing in the past. And it's that's central to physics. So in that sense, I suppose the pattern that is us could, in some sense, exist into the far future. It's interesting what you say about religion is that I think, and I'm very careful in the show, and I'm not dodging questions. I firmly believe that music is a central part of the show, and art and beauty, these beautiful images of space, they're all part of the show. Philosophy, theology, these are all different ways of trying to answer the question, which is what does it mean to live this finite, fragile life in an infinite and possibly eternal universe? Those are questions that we all grapple with at one time or another. And I think these are all necessary attempts to answer it. Science is one of those things. It gives you a framework. That's what it does. But I say usually in the show, you don't find meaning through the eyepiece of a telescope, right? But what you do is you see that there are 2 trillion galaxies out there in the bit of the universe we can see. You discover we're not the center of the universe. That was really important. That came with the invention of the telescope, that realization. So I think it's very important not to set up conflicts between different views of the world. We're all really trying to get to the same question, which is, what does all this mean? That science is necessary. It's a very important part of it because it shows you nature as nature is, but it doesn't tell you what it means. We need all the other things for that.
Well, the other part of that would be in your audience, people having sudden existential crises. There is this balance between showing and sharing the fragility of existence in the universe, but also the beauty. There's sort of a bit of a seesaw there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. We start the show actually with this beautiful piece of music, which is Sibelius's 5th symphony, the 3rd movement. And it was composed in 1915, which is kind of not coincidentally the year that Einstein's theory of general relativity was published. So I did notice that when I chose the music. But that's a piece of music about, at one level, Sibelius said it's about swans taking flight from a lake in northern Finland. But at another level, it really is about the deep beauty of nature. And Einstein had this wonderful quote. I tell the story. I'm giving all the whole show away now.
a teaser, indeed.
It's a lovely story Einstein had about when he was young and his dad gave him a compass, you know, and he noticed the needle points north all the time. And he said he was about 6 or 7 years old. And he thought, there's something here. There's something invisible, some deeper thing in nature that's causing this thing to point north. I can't see it, but it's there. And he said later he realized that when you pay attention to nature carefully and appreciate its beauty and you're curious and you try to understand it, you can catch a glimpse of something deeply hidden. That was his words, something deeply hidden, which is the deep structure and beauty of nature. And that music does that. And science does that. So that's the sense in which I think, you have to face the universe as it really is. You said that there is a sense of existential challenge when you contemplate the majesty and size and scale of it all. But ultimately, the way to approach it is to notice the beauty as well, of which we are a part because we can perceive it.
So when we try to convey, and when you try to convey some of that beauty on stage in your live show, you mentioned music, you mentioned some of the images from deep space. There's also an incredible kind of graphical element to the show as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, the screens are central. So we have huge LED screens. The technology, even since I was last in Australia, I think it was 2019, 2018, the technology's moved on so much. So now you can have these enormous screens. So we put as much as we can in the arenas. So 30 meters wide, you know, huge things. And so that allows us to, as you said, show the real images, but also create some images. So we for one of the things, because black holes are really central because they're such fascinating things. We created a flyby of a black hole using computer code that was developed for the film Interstellar, which is really Einstein's equations encoded into the graphics software.
I love that that movie. When you mentioned that the idea of a book falling into a black hole, that was the first image I thought of, because obviously Matthew McConaughey's bookshelf is at the end of the black hole for him.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not a coincidence, actually, because Kip Thorne, who's Nobel Prize winner, a friend of mine, one of the greatest living physicists, he essentially wrote that film initially. So you're right to make those connections. He was very clever in that all that wonderful stuff we've talked about for years in physics is in that film.
So what's the one thing you want the audience to take away from this very special live on stage show?
I think it's and I talk about this at the end, it's the perspective. My great hero Carl Sagan said it. He said astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. And the humbling is easy, right? We're tiny. But the character-building is the fact that I talk about biology, I talk about the origin of life, the evolution of civilizations, all those things. And ultimately what you come to realize, or I come to realize, is that this planet, notwithstanding its physical insignificance, might be astonishingly valuable, because you can make the argument, and I do actually, you can make the argument that on the average, there might be only a handful or even one civilization in a typical galaxy. And that means that Earth is the only place where a civilization exists, and therefore meaning and beauty and all those things exist in an island of 400 billion suns. And so the message I'd like people to take away is that we do have actually a profound responsibility not to mess this up, right? Because if we mess it up deliberately or through inaction, we might eliminate meaning in a galaxy forever. And that's basically the thought.
Yeah, well, we only get one pale blue dot. I think that's an important message for everyone. Yeah, yeah. Professor Brian Cox, absolute pleasure, a humble pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that was scientist Professor Brian Cox, BBC science broadcaster and author. His live show is coming to Australia. You can check online for details. It's called Horizons.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.